It is the core funding for wildlife conservation and it has been for decades.
Gun sales, taxes pay for wildlife conservation projects in Alaska, and the fund is growing. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, citing financial reasons, Representative Sam Keto will not seek re-election.
With this reduction, I'm in a situation now of having to choose whether I run again or whether I take money out of my daughter's college account to continue this job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
At this hour, House lawmakers are holding floor debate on the Alaska State Operating Budget. The debate began this morning at 11 a.m. So far, votes have been held on dozens of amendments. The lawmakers plan to break for dinner and resume debate later tonight and into Wednesday. House leadership says it will accept individual members' amendments through noon tomorrow. You can tune into Gavel Alaska's live coverage on 360 North Television, 360north.org, and Gavel Alaska's Facebook page. Americans have spent a lot of money on guns and ammunition in recent years, and that has sent revenues pouring into Alaska's budget for wildlife conservation. The money flow is due to the Pittman-Robertson Act, a 1939 law that imposes a tax on firearms and sends it to the states for wildlife projects. Today, the U.S. Interior Department announced Alaska's share of the tax revenues is $33 million, more than double what the state got just 6 years ago. The allocation formula takes geographic size into account, so Alaska is getting more from the fund than any state besides Texas. Maria Gladyshevsky is the Deputy Director of Alaska's Division of Wildlife Conservation.
Pittman-Robertson funds account for the majority of our funding, of our division's funding. It is the core funding for wildlife conservation and has been for decades.
Gladyshevsky says the revenues have gone up so steeply that it's hard to make full use of them. The state has had to give back about $3 million since 2016. Gladyshevsky says the state has spent some of its money on things like road pullouts and trails to give hunters better access.
We are doing our best to obligate all those funds and do good projects for Alaskans and for Alaska wildlife.
Also, it's been a challenge for the state to come up with a required 25% match. So last year, the Alaska legislature boosted state revenues by increasing the cost of hunting and fishing licenses with instructions not to leave federal money on the table. Nationally, gun sales shot up during the years Barack Obama was president. Some indicators show they dropped sharply in the months after President Trump took office. When a home heating oil tank leaks, costs can add up quickly. Depending on the size of the spill, everything from hiring contractors to buying cleanup supplies and even calling the state to report the spill gets billed. Alaska's lawmakers are considering legislation to help with those costs. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more in Juneau.
In 2010, Fabian Peter Contessa's family found a cork-sized hole in the bottom of their underground heating oil tank in Juneau. Peter Contessa told a House Resources Committee last month that as soon as they discovered the leak, the family called the state's Department of Environmental Conservation for help. A spill expert came out, gave them some advice on what to do, and the family started cleanup.
So we went out, spent a lot of money on a lot of boom, a lot of absorbent pads, sloshing through our property, disposing of the free product and the pads, etc., in an environmentally responsible way.
It wasn't cheap.
We spent tens of thousands of dollars on this effort, cleanup, hiring the contractor. We've spent several thousand dollars on soil testing, and none of this is covered by homeowners insurance. So that is all out of pocket.
Peter Contessa says that DEC staff has been a great resource for technical support and answering questions. But then in 2017, the family got their first bill from the state.
And as you can imagine, the blood pressure shot through the roof.
They didn't want to pay that bill in addition to all of the other ones, so the family stopped talking to the state spill response staff. State Spill Prevention and Response Director Kristen Ryan says that's a common response.
We have had several situations where a homeowner is talking to us, everything is going well. Then several weeks later, they get our bill, which is an automated process. And all of a sudden, they don't return our phone calls. They won't let us on their property. They don't want to talk to us because they don't want another bill.
Right now, staff at the Department of Environmental Conservation are required by law to recover their costs when they consult on spills. On average, getting technical support from employees in that division can cost between $100 and $150 an hour. But Ryan says she doesn't think that when the statutes were written, lawmakers were considering individual homeowners and heating oil leaks.
They were thinking about Exxon. They were thinking about BP. They were thinking about big companies that are making money off oil. And they didn't think the state should have any expenses associated with that industry.
There are about 150 homes that have heating oil spills that the state is currently consulting on. The bill is pretty narrowly defined to cover just spills from equipment or fuel that is used solely to provide space heat or electric power for residential homes. It wouldn't take away any of the cleanup costs, which is typically the bulk of the cost in a situation where heating oil is spilled. But it would allow the state to provide essentially free tech support when something does go wrong. Ryan says spill response experts for the state do everything from helping homeowners draft bids for contractors to showing them where to buy supplies to clean up the spills themselves.
Or go out with a meter that helps them see if the vapors are strong enough in the house that perhaps they should move or leave while they're doing the cleanup. Things that are to us really important to do, and we'd like to do them without burdening them with a bill.
If the bill passes, Ryan's department estimates that it'll lose out on about $60,000 a year in revenue. Ryan says she's confident the state can absorb that cost, especially if it entices homeowners into reporting spills and getting help cleaning them up. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
The Juneau Empire reports that Representative Sam Keto III will not run for re-election this fall. Keto represents House District 33, including Skagway, Haines, Cluckwan, Gustavus, Downtown Juneau, and Douglas. Keto could not be reached for comment today. He told the Empire he made his decision Friday due to financial concerns. Last week, the legislature let the State Officers Compensation Commission cut per diem payments for lawmakers living within 50 miles of the state capitol. That means Juneau's three state lawmakers will not receive a daily allowance on top of their annual salary during regular or special sessions. Lawmakers had 60 days to pass legislation rejecting the commission's recommendation, but did not act. Keto spoke about the recommendation at a meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee on March 7th. The single parent said he had saved money during his career as an engineer for his daughter's college tuition. He said his job as a legislator was forcing him to draw from his savings.
With this reduction, I'm in a situation now of having to choose whether I run again or whether I take money out of my daughter's college account to continue this job, and I'm not prepared to do that.
Keto says the increasing length of regular and special sessions has made it a nearly full-time job. He added that he has not been able to bill hours through his consulting job for 3 years due to time commitment.
If the choice or the decision of the Compensation Commission was to pressure legislators to not run, they've succeeded, at least if this goes forward.
Keto, a former civil engineer and legislative lobbyist, was selected from among nine other applicants for former Representative Beth Kurtula's open seat in 2014. He's been reelected twice. So far, Democrat Sarah Hannon and Independent Chris Diamond have filed to run for Keto's seat. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the indigenous halibut hook is deemed a Hall of Fame worthy innovation.
My hooks never did hang on the wall. They hung out on the porch.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Unlocking Alaska's Energy Resources.
A former Anchorage resident was sentenced on Thursday in Dillingham for recklessly flying low over a boater several years ago. Benjamin Hancock unintentionally hit the man in the head with the ski of the float plane he was piloting. Hancock pleaded guilty to felony assault, and he will pay a fine and restitution, but he will not serve any jail time. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Flying recklessly is illegal, and the consequences can be devastating. That was the central message of Travis Finkenbinder's family and the assistant district attorney Allison O'Leary at Benjamin Hancock's sentencing hearing. In 2014, Hancock and Finkenbinder were working together to move skiffs from one section of the Mulchatna River to another for their employer. Hancock was providing air support, piloting a de Havilland DHC-2 Beaver float plane. Hancock took off from the river, heading in the same direction as Finkenbinder, who was driving a boat. Hancock flew low over the boat, and the ski of Hancock's plane hit Finkenbinder in the head. Finkenbinder survived, but suffered extensive permanent brain damage. He remains in a minimally conscious state, unable to hold up his head, speak, or eat. He can respond to basic questions inconsistently with a thumbs up. Doctors have said his condition will not improve. At the hearing, Captain Scott Quist, an Alaska State Wildlife Trooper and veteran pilot who was stationed in King Salmon when the tragedy occurred, took the stand as the state's expert witness. Quist said that he saw no reasonable explanation for Hancock not clearing Finkenbinder and his boat by hundreds of feet.
Based on everything that I read, from interviews, from performance data, from the weather conditions, everything I know about it, they think that Mr. Hancock intentionally flew the aircraft at extremely low altitude and did a buzz job.
A buzz job, or buzzing, is slang in the aviation community for intentionally making a low pass over something or someone. Travis Finkenbinder's father, Arthur Finkenbinder, provided a victim impact statement at the hearing.
The incident involved the destruction of an extraordinary human being. I would say to buzz a person with an airplane is stupid, no matter the height of the airplane. To buzz closely is insane. To buzz and hit another human being is criminal assault and battery, arrogant, insane, and stupid.
As a part of a plea deal with the state, Hancock will avoid jail time. He pleaded guilty to felony assault in the third degree and agreed to pay restitution of $6,100 to Travis Finkenbinder's family. Supreme Court Judge Christina Ray ordered Hancock to pay a fine of $25,000 to the state. However, she expressed doubt that a sentence without jail time will send a strong message to the aviation community. If active jail time were on the table, she said she would have ordered it.
Buzzing is a problem, and we all know it. And it's something that can end very badly, which it did in this particular situation. And so I think sending the right message to the, especially in Bush, Alaska, where we all are flying all of the time, I think that is really, really important.
Hancock was tearful throughout the testimony and victim impact statements of Travis Finkenbinder's wife and father. During his own statement, he apologized to the victim's family.
I know there's nothing I can say to take away the pain and cement that Travis and the family have endured, nor to ease the burden moving forward, and for that I'm truly sorry. I intend to make this lesson. Guide me in efforts to become a better person and not to be the person I was on June 25th, 2014.
Hancock, who now lives in Colorado, was given 3 months of unsupervised probation and 18 months suspended jail time in addition to the fine and restitution he was ordered to pay. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The total allowable catch for the 2018 Pacific halibut season in the Gulf of Alaska and Southeast will be set slightly lower than what U.S. commissioners on the International Pacific Halibut Commission had asked for. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration published a final rule in the Federal Register yesterday, setting combined charter and commercial quotas in Southeast Area 2C at 4.4 million pounds. In all, Alaskan charter and halibut fishermen will be allowed to harvest 20.5 million pounds, down about 2 million from last year. This comes after Canadian and U.S. IPHC commissioners, who typically set quotas together, could not come to an agreement at their annual meeting in January, the first time since 1990. Both countries decided to set quotas through their own domestic rulemaking processes. According to a NOAA press release, the U.S. will continue following the IPHC process, but says it may seek to renegotiate the 1923 treaty that created the international regulatory body in order to improve the circumstances for U.S. fishermen. The 2018 halibut season will open on March 24th. In Sitka, about half of residents use heating fuel to keep warm in the winter. Another 40% use electricity produced by hydropower from a local dam. And there's plenty of grumbling in town about an electric rate increase to pay for a recent hydro expansion project. But as part of our Cost of Cold series from Alaska's Energy Desk, we talked to one man in Sitka who has contentedly tinkered away at his own homegrown solution. Richard Parmalee warms his house with vegetable oil donated by a local Chinese restaurant and McDonald's.
Oh man, you guys got a lot of oil today.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna relieve you of some of that.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
My name is Richard Parmalee. I've lived in Sitka about 30 years. About 10 years ago, I converted the boiler to a vegetable oil system. And I have not bought diesel in probably 10 years for heating oil.
Thanks.
Yeah,
no, see ya.
See you.
So this is the original boiler room, okay? This is a brand new boiler. We just replaced the old one, but it just has a basic burner on it, just like any diesel burner. The difference is this is set up to heat either vegetable oil or motor oil. Oops. It's going to act up on me. There we go. I think it's cool. 10 years I've been using vegetable oil, I probably saved $30,000 or $40,000. You know, and for me, that's where I'm coming from. Reusable energy, but I'm saving money also. Just quiet. It's personal. My aunt, I have an aunt who, she actually just turned 81. She's my favorite aunt. And her and my cousin were up here 3 or 4 years ago, and I was running around doing stuff. And one day she sat down and says, Dick, she says, where in the world did you learn how to fix things? I said, I have no idea. She said, because you weren't that way when you were growing up. I said, no, I just wanted to play. If you look around and just watch Alaskans as a general rule, we're tinkerers. We make things work because we have to make things work.
Depends on which way to use it.
Sometimes my exhaust smells like French fries, and sometimes it smells like wontons. No, I can't smell it today.
French fries.
Mm-hmm. French fries. Or wontons.
The Cost of Cold is a series from Alaska's Energy Desk about how Alaskans around the state heat their homes. Reporter Emily Kwong produced this story in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
The Alaska Innovators Hall of Fame recently inducted its first indigenous tool. Few people still use the hand-carved halibut hook, once popular with Southeast tribes, but there's a push to make sure the tradition sticks around for future generations. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
Standing with his grandson at the Juneau Innovation Summit a few weeks ago,
Thomas George accepted an award.
I've been trying to get help to keep this part of our heritage alive for years or decades.
The Alaska State Committee on Research gives credit to people and inventions which have made a lasting impact in the state. George accepted the honor for a collective achievement, the halibut hook, which has been used by Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for thousands of years. Even though the technology is old, George says it isn't a relic.
Over the years, everybody thought it was a decoration for the wall, but my hooks never did hang on the wall. They hung out on the porch.
George only knows one other person in Southeast Alaska who fishes with the traditional halibut hook, and he's a big proponent for bringing them back. He's taught classes at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute on how to make them. Growing up in Klawak, he says carving the hooks was part of his childhood. His grandmother was one of the people who passed on the knowledge. And he remembers some advice she gave him. All of the measurements you need to know are in your own hand.
If you got small hands, you don't need a big fish.
Typically, people jig for halibut on their boat using a metal circle hook. But the traditional design and method is different. The hook itself is shaped like a V, with a more buoyant wood like yellow cedar on one side and a denser wood on the other. This makes it float in a certain direction. And George says the best part about fishing this way is you can set the line in the water and come back later. It's suspended by floats.
You could go to the beach and build a fire and boil coffee.
Before he sets the hooks, George talks to them.
Telling them that she's coming down to fight.
Each of his hooks is named after a different girlfriend, which he admits can sometimes be confusing.
It's getting harder to remember all my girlfriend's names, Lincoln names, so catching less and less fish.
But over the years, he says, there have been plenty of fish in the sea. Just one hook alone, he estimates, has caught about 800 halibut. He says even though the practice is sustainable and effective, fishing the traditional way hasn't always been encouraged. Back in the 1970s, before there were subsistence permits, he invited a state trooper to see the halibut hooks in action. And after about 5 minutes, George had a halibut on the line.
And we rolled him in, and he pulled up beside us, and he says, "My God," he says, "I was going to confiscate your gear and write you a citation, but..." He said that was truly amazing just to witness.
George begged the trooper to write him a citation because he wanted to challenge the issue in court. But the trooper was elated. He never bothered him again. In 2000, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council established a subsistence program for halibut. But George thinks there's still roadblocks to preserving the traditional ways. Having to obtain a subsistence permit at all, he says, creates an additional barrier. And he'd like to see more people use the hand-carved halibut hook.
So that, you know, that part of our heritage does not die.
George wishes the Alaska legislature would address the issue and take it up with the Regional Fishery Management Council. In the meantime, he's doing his part to make sure the next generation knows how to make the traditional hooks. His 14-year-old grandson has already picked up the skill.
Well, he hasn't said much except for let's go fishing.
George says the state recognizes the halibut hook is an important innovation. It's a technology worth keeping around. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The spring equinox occurred at 8:15 this morning in Alaska. And no, that doesn't mean you can balance a raw egg on end. But it does mean the sun is directly over the equator, giving equal amounts of daylight and darkness around the world. Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says the March equinox is often confused with the first day of spring.
It is not the first day of spring as if we're talking about climate, which that's what we're doing. If you're an astronomer, we would consider this the first day of astronomical spring. And I know all our calendars say, you know, first day of spring, people saying happy spring, first day of spring. It's not the first day of spring. From the climate point of view, it is the 20th day of spring. We like to use whole calendar months, and that actually tends to work really well. So March, April, May is going to be our spring season.
And does the equinox mean anything in terms of climate?
No, it means absolutely nothing. Except for, you know, it's a point of reference of solar energy. So we have, you know, everywhere on the Earth basically has about the same amount of daylight on the spring equinox as they do on the fall equinox. So we can use that as a measure of solar input. But other than that, there's really no climatological significance.
Okay, we have the same amount of daylight today as we do in the September equinox. Why is it so much colder in the spring then?
That's a great question. So here in March, obviously we have snow in the ground. It's, you know, in the teens in the northern part of the state. It's in the 20s in the interior, 30s in the southern part of the state. In September, we would have temperatures in the 40s, 50s, and even 60s. A big difference. So the main reason for that is what we call thermal lag. So the Earth is about two-thirds ocean water, and that ocean water takes a long time to heat up in the summer. And so we see the warmest temperatures, you know, after the summer solstice. But then conversely, it takes a long time for it to cool off coming into the spring. So even though the shortest day of the year with the least solar input was late December, it takes a long time for that that summer heat to dissipate. But then it takes a long time for the new solar energy to start to warm that water up. So when you have two-thirds of the Earth, that's water. It's got that cold, cold air, the cold temperatures from the winter. It just takes a long time for it to start to warm up.
Is the time between the spring and the fall equinox equal?
So we might think, okay, hey, we're halfway there. We're halfway from the low point of winter to the high point of summer. But we're actually still a couple days away. It's going to happen on March 22nd. And the reason for that is we have this elliptical orbit. So it actually, we move slower around the sun during the time from the March equinox over to the fall equinox, so the warm half of the year. So the warm half of the year is actually about 186 days, whereas the cold half of the year is about 178 days. So it's about 7.5, 8 days longer. And we see that reflected, say, in the summer where up on the North Slope, they have more days with no sunset than they have in the winter, no days with sunrise. So so we actually, here in the Northern Hemisphere, we actually get a little bit longer warm season than we have a cold season in the winter.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea, Elizabeth Jenkins, Rasha McChesney, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Avery Lill in Dillingham, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Annie Fite in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.